Chapter 6. The Hunter. 11th of February, estimated. The algae under the ice has changed color slightly from blue to dark purple, she wrote, kneeling down by the riverbank the next morning. There are also new structures appearing among it that look like wasps' nests. Occasionally, a small, fast-moving creature will swim into one or leave one, but the ice blurs their shape so I can't make out their exact size. They remind me of fireflies. They have a gentle, golden-tipped glow and weave through the water like there's no resistance. I estimate they're about an inch long. They're quite beautiful. I'll also assume they're lethal until further notice. Lucy finished sketching the underwater wasp nests and refocused her attention on the beast's carcass. Resuming the autopsy, she noticed that it was steaming more than the day before. Its organs were visibly more shriveled, and it felt drier to the touch. She was racing the clock. The creature's nose was long, like a bear's, and the nasal cavity had dozens, if not hundreds, of small muscles running its full length. Lucy made more incisions through the thick fur, then tugged the layer of skin away to reveal the skull. She paused, contemplating how to proceed. Not sure how to open the skull without damaging the brain's structure inside, she wrote. We'll explore the rest of the body until I can think of a solution. If this thing can smell a drop of blood from a mile away, I'm guessing it's got one hell of an olfactory bulb in there. She abandoned her notepad again and turned her attention back to the mouth area. The creature had no esophagus. The back of its mouth cavity was a sealed flap of thick, leather-like skin. There's no way it can feed through its mouth, she noted next to her drawing. The serrated teeth must be purely used as weapons, which means the creature must ingest its prey through some other part of the body. But no other part seemed obvious. Just as it had no functional mouth, it had nothing resembling an anus, no visible way of excreting. Its buttocks were a sealed entity from the outside, connecting to none of the plumbing humans or other mammals had. Lucy was dumbstruck. This thing has no stomach, no way to digest food, she wrote. Her mind flashed back to the victims of beast attacks she'd seen. All had puncture marks on their bodies, and all had degraded to gen water within 48 hours of being attacked. There had to be a link. Working hypothesis, she scrawled in her notebook, is that the black coils are projected like tentacles, puncturing their victims. This would fit with the size of punctures I saw on Dan and Toby. Maybe the tentacles inject victims with an enzyme or toxin that causes the liquefaction? I found white chalky powder on the ends of each tentacle. Perhaps that could be the enzyme. I need to investigate its properties. Her examinations began to stray from the torso. As she cut deep into the creature's forearm, forcing the blade upwards from its paw to its elbow, globules of sticky, glistening gen water leaked out onto the frozen ground beneath. Prizing the two sides of flesh apart, Lucy discovered a series of small interconnected chambers and valves situated between the bands of muscle. The same phenomenon occurred in its legs and shoulders and in the muscles lining the spine. Chambers of gen water are all over the beast's body, she wrote. She returned to the arm she'd started with. The lowest chamber ended in a dark black band of muscle, a sphincter, which led to the center of the creature's paw. Taking the paw in her hand, she searched its center for the perforation. Carefully brushing aside jets of overlapping white hair, she revealed the outside of the sphincter. She teased the knife tip through the hole. As predicted, it emerged inside the first arm chamber. She scribbled frantically as her theory gained traction. I've found gen water chambers lining all the major muscle groups of the body. I think they must be energy stores. Each paw has a sphincter which links to the first chamber of that limb. My guess is that's how the gen water enters the body. The beasts have no way of swallowing through their mouths, so this seems the only alternative. It would also explain why they don't eat their prey at the point of attack. They wait for them to turn to gen water, then somehow absorb the liquid through these openings. As Lucy gazed into the distance, chewing on the end of her pencil, something fluttered across her line of sight. A beautiful, multicolored butterfly skipped across the light breeze, blowing precariously from side to side until it tumbled down into the grass by her foot. Lucy kept her body rigid. Moving only the tip of her pencil, she sketched the butterfly as quickly as she could. It bore the same warm autumnal colors as its predecessors on the train track all those months ago. The creature basked in the sunlight with its wings held upright back to back. Lucy did a double take. She ceased sketching and scrutinized the insect. Beads of sweat were appearing on the creature's wings, small, shiny blobs steadily growing larger. Lucy stared for a further minute, observing as neighboring blobs began to interconnect until eventually both wings were entirely covered by a thin, shimmering layer of liquid. The wings began to droop under the weight. Slowly, gravity prized the bowing tips apart. But as they parted, they revealed an impossible, rippling body of water between them. It filled the V-shaped space from each wingtip down to the body. As the wings continued to droop downwards, the insect's body and legs began to dissolve, seemingly fueling the rippling pool above it. Finally, the wings reached near horizontality on the uneven grass, forming a reddish-orange disc. Over them was a shimmering hemisphere of liquid, much like a snow globe. Lucy stared in astonishment as the wings themselves were drained of their color and became completely transparent. The invisible wing disc began to recede inwards towards the center, causing the snow globe to rise until it formed a full sphere with half the radius of its previous form. Before Lucy could resume her sketching, the now spherical globule rippled once more and rolled toward the river, where it tipped over the edge and vanished into the stream. A smoky scent brought her attention back to the beast's carcass. The steady wisps of vapor had turned to smoke. She staggered to her feet and leapt back, not a moment too soon. The entire corpse burst into flame. She stared, open-mouthed, as the creature's body burned into nothingness right before her eyes. Later that evening, once she'd finished her frenetic note-making, sketching both the butterfly's transformation and the beast's combustion, she re-examined the chalky white powder, studying the tub in the kitchen. She resolved to make a plan. 11th February, estimated. I have to observe one feeding. It's the only way. By observe, I mean indirectly, obviously. Pretty sure direct observation would be suicidal. Plus, I don't have night vision goggles. Firstly, I need to catch some bait. She paused and considered how Josh the botanist would have approached such an experiment. Given his fastidious documentation of everything, she reasoned that he'd probably refer to the evidence routinely. Dan, for his part, had always been extremely methodical and was good at sequential planning. She decided to channel both approaches and see if her logic stacked up. I know that victims of the beast turn to Genwater. I know from first-hand observations that victims have puncture marks which match the size of the beast's tentacles. My hypothesis is that an enzyme or equivalent is administered via the tentacles, which then turns the victims to Genwater. I believe the white chalk powder may be this enzyme. To test this hypothesis, I need to observe the decay process again. I need to lay bait. If the white beast's carcass is anything to go by, I suspect there are more beasts in the forest. Assuming they discover the bait and puncture it at early nightfall, and I check the traps first thing each morning, there will be a maximum of 12 hours that elapse before the effects are observed. I'll need two baits, really, so I can use one as a control. The first bait will simply be left in the trap as I find it, unaltered. I expect it to turn to Genwater within 24 hours. To the second bait, however, I'll add white powder, and then study it for a few hours to see if it accelerates the decay process. If I'm right about the powder enzyme hypothesis, the second bait should decay much faster than the first. If this powder is the thing that causes victims to decay to Genwater, then maybe I can start figuring out ways to stop it from working. An antidote, I guess. It's gotta be worth a shot. The next day, she crossed the river and set her first traps along the periphery of the forest, following the trees lining the road for about 2 miles. The forest was unnervingly dark. In 4 months of occupying the farmhouse, this was the closest she'd come to it. Going in there alone had no appeal. It would be all too easy to become disoriented. As she skirted the edge, anxious to lay the traps as far from the house as was practical, a dripping sound caught her attention. She paused and looked up, holding out her palm to face the cloudy sky. No rain. Warily, she turned her attention to the trees. Somewhere, hidden in the depths of the forest, was the pitter-patter of invisible rainfall. This was more than the steady drips of ice melting from the branches. It sounded like a localized shower. Lucy laid the first trap and continued walking, peering into the forest as she went. After a few hundred yards, she knelt down to lay the next trap. A dry twig snapped somewhere in the forest, making her freeze rigid. "Relax, Luce. Be cool," she whispered under her breath as she scanned her surroundings like a meerkat. The thought of an unknown number of beasts roaming the landscape wasn't reassuring, but it wasn't new either. It had formed most of her nightmares for the first month on the farm. "They're nocturnal," she reassured herself. "That's the sound of the bait. It's a good thing. Be cool." As she continued along the forest edge to lay the final trap, a glistening on the road caught her eye. She followed the trail of liquid from the tar to a dripping tree. She approached cautiously and took out her notepad. "Parts of the forest sound like rain. I haven't entered to investigate, but I found a tree on the periphery that's sweating. It's covered in globules from the ground up to the canopy. They're small, transparent studs dotting the bark at frequent intervals. The other trees that I can see nearby are dry, so I guess this one is the furthest the dripping has spread. I can't see anything dead in the branches, nothing that could be decaying to gen water, so I'm guessing some of the trees have become infected. Perhaps something they're absorbing through their roots?" She put the diary away and turned her attention to the third trap. The first two, a pair of old-fashioned mouse traps from under the kitchen sink, had been easy enough to set. This last one was altogether more lethal. "Easy does it," she soothed herself as she carefully laid out the ancient, rusting bear trap from the barn. With immense care, she prized the trap open and set it. Standing as far back as possible, she prodded the central pressure platform with a stick. The trap leapt from the ground as the rusty iron teeth clamped shut, chomping the stick in two. "That'll do it," she said, in half a mind to lay it somewhere in the house should those bastards in the SUV come back. The first day yielded no bait. The only difference was that the sweating tree by the bear trap had dried out overnight. The river had continued to melt, however, destabilizing Lucy's ladder bridge as the ice banks thinned and receded, taking with them the submerged wasp nests and the mysterious firefly creatures. Most of the algae had disappeared, too. Only small pockets remained, clinging to the underside of the remaining ice. Lucy spent the day resecuring the bridge by tying together a series of wooden pallets from the barn, then pegging them to the ground on both riverbanks with fence posts. Together, the pallets formed a chain of stepping stones, stabilized by the ladder, which lay tied across the central three to keep the bridge in shape. Today's bait checking was proving equally fruitless. Lucy's heart sank as she found the third and final trap empty once again that morning. As she retraced her route along the road back towards the river, a tremendous crunching racket sounded to her left. Lucy leapt back from the forest edge just in time as a tree crashed to the ground, bursting out onto the frosty tar below. The tall oak tree continued to shake on its side until the last shockwaves dissipated. "What the... Oh, fuck this place!" Lucy exclaimed, looking around for someone to agree with her. She waited for her heart rate to settle before examining the fallen tree. Entwined among the uppermost branches were purple leaves, incongruous among the barren winter branches of the oak itself. Lucy examined the long trunk. A thick, twisting purple ivy clung to the sides of the tree, coiled tightly around both trunk and branches alike, spreading out in all directions. She squinted and stared into the dark forest at the base of the fallen tree. The ivy was as thick as the oak's lower branches. Lucy took out her notepad. The base of the tree had been crushed in two. When she returned the next day, the tree was all but gone, reduced to a trail of goop that trickled across the tar. Lucy stared incredulously at the spot where she'd nearly been flattened just 24 hours ago. Not only was the tree liquefied, but the purple ivy had retreated substantially too. It now only slightly protruded from the shadowy forest boundary. As Lucy stopped and stared, she noticed a faint rustling. With extreme caution, she edged towards the ivy and knelt down. At glacial speed, the great coils were retreating before her eyes. Each minuscule root would move in turn like a millipede's leg, sending a small wave across segments of coil. The faint rustling was disturbed by another crashing sound, this time more distant. "The ivy must be making its way through the forest," she noted. This time Lucy's venture was not entirely in vain. She used the opportunity to lay a fourth trap, having discovered an additional mouse trap in the barn. 15th of February. Hoping the extra trap increases my chances. Either that or I've just added a needless half mile to my daily checking routine. On the fourth day, Lucy's perseverance paid off. Luck struck twice, with two baits being caught in one night. A dead hare lay in the bear trap, its body horribly mangled between the metal teeth, a fateful, bloodied morsel of carrot just inches from its bulging eyes. The ill-fated hare had been visited already. Lucy examined the gruesome, fluffy mess and quickly spotted the crucial puncture marks she was looking for. It was already well into its decay process. The body had torn in two as the lower half fell away from the top, pinned as it was between those uncompromising iron fangs. Some sweating flesh remained in place, droplets slowly falling off to the ground. Lucy prodded a piece of the suspended skin with her glove. It stuck to her fingers like melting wax, just as Dan's cheek had done. The semi-liquid flesh peeled away with her as she withdrew her glove, becoming translucent as it stretched until finally it broke off from the rest of the mangled body. The fragment began to liquefy further, trickling off the tips of Lucy's glove and dripping onto the ground where the small globules began to roll back towards the wet bear trap. She watched as they pooled beneath the dripping corpse of the hare. From the tub she'd brought with her, Lucy gingerly removed a small amount of the white powder that she'd taken from the tentacles of the white beast carcass and scraped it onto the hare's body. To the second punctured bit of bait a quarter of a mile away, an unhappy-looking field vole caught in the recently added mouse trap, Lucy did nothing, leaving it untouched. "All right, Lucy Young, time to see if you're on the money," she said to herself, as she sat down on the road, notepad in hand, and recorded the approximate time. February 16th, estimated. It's roughly 10 a.m., I think. I caught two things in one night. They were both punctured, which confirms that there's at least one living beast in the forest. I've put white powder on the bigger sample, a hare, and I'm observing the effect. If I'm right, the hare should be fully degraded to gen water by midday, whereas the vole won't reach the last stages of decay until nightfall. Lucy swapped her pen for a pencil and began sketching the hare's body. 3 hours passed, during which time she ambled between the two successful traps and sketched the differences. "It's past midday, and I think I have to accept I was wrong. The hare's carcass isn't any more decayed than the vole's." She hesitated as the revelation sank in. "In fact, it may be actively slowing the rate of decay. Could it be that the chalky powder is what killed the white beast in the first place? Maybe it's toxic to them, not us. I'm low on firewood and hungry, so I'm stopping observations for today. If my new hypothesis is correct, I expect that when I return tomorrow, the hare's carcass will still be here, and the vole will be gone." Her hand trembled with excitement as she wrote. "If I can prove it, then I may have stumbled across the creature's weakness, something they're biologically vulnerable to. I might have discovered a weapon against them."